they are. And then when they boast about who they are.
Hey, Michael. How are you? Right.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Michael Brooks is the co-host of The Majority Report and the host of his own podcast called The Michael Brooks Show. In this episode, we discuss the anti-social justice warrior industry, whether or not Zero Squared is just a Marxist version of Dave Rubin, and the need for debate on the left. It's Wednesday, February 7th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you haven't already, you might sign up to our membership podcast through our Patreon account. Conversations like this one are fairly regular on that channel, the second half of conversations like this one. But it won't be easy. You'll also hear C. Derek Varn's Symptomatic Redness fairly regularly, as well as the podcast Alternatives, through our Patreon feed. As far as Zero Books titles that are worth reading, consider picking up Anselm Jappe's The Writing on the Wall or Sean Scott's Millennials and the Moments That Made Us. The music you're listening to right now is Enmesh's Warp Zone, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Michael Brooks and I discuss the materialist left and how to fight the new right. Well, let's just jump in, huh? I'm kind of eager to talk to you, mostly about what it's like to be kind of a broadcaster or a podcaster on the left from your perspective, which I think is going to be really different, or at least somewhat different from mine. You know, I just started doing this in my office like 9 years ago because I wanted to, and you seem to you seem to have more of a professional career as a media person. So I'm interested.
And so what do you host the show, you're a publisher and a writer?
Yes. So I'm a short story writer, a novelist. I work freelance for John Hunt Publishing as their publishing manager and publicist for Zero Books.
Yep.
And I write copy for a legal tech company and for a vocabulary company. And so, yeah, I work at home now and have for a couple of years and do all this stuff. But I've never been on the radio or didn't get a communications degree, you know, worked as a telemarketer for a long time.
Oh, far out. That's a fucked up job. I mean, we can get into it, but I don't have like a linear path to what I do either. And I'm also, I'm happy to talk about, what I've been really enjoying in what I've caught of your show. And I think, we're obviously kind of, I think there's a certain ecosystem that we're both a part of with like your show, my show. I would put Adam Proctor's show in this, Jacobin, Chapo. There's this sort of like emergent, I think obviously first and foremost, much more sort of avowedly socialist and materialist in orientation, but then at the same time, much more kind of like pop literate. And I think actually smart about avoiding a lot of the kind of like modern culture war stuff without drawing a false equivalency, which I think is important. So, yeah, I'm happy to get into all of it, man.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, I'm recording and, I think that right there is like maybe a great way to start. Let's talk about that ecosystem a little bit. And one thing I wanted to ask you about is how to avoid the cult, because I sometimes avoid them and I sometimes intervene in ways that get me in trouble.
Right.
I interviewed Lindsay Shepherd, for instance.
which
oh, how dare you! I'm off of the show.
Right. Well, I wanted to interview her because I thought she was treated badly, and I thought the left's response was counterproductive. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with Jordan Peterson on much, and I didn't. But that didn't mean that just because you showed a clip from a TV show that he was on that you were attacking people or needed to be reprimanded. But the other thing, the reason I wanted to talk to her, she was becoming, and is now still, she was becoming kind of a darling of, I don't know, is it the alt-right? Is it the alt-light? It's hard to say, but she was becoming a darling of the anti-social justice warrior industry. That's how I think.
Right.
And I wanted to let her know that, you know, free speech is not just an issue for these guys. And in fact, they're not really committed to free speech as a principle, or at least not in any principled way. And so that's why we had that conversation. I had that conversation with her. But how would you have had her on your show?
I'll give you a two-part answer. And the first part of it is like an honest cop-out. So actually, no, three parts. One, the simplest answer is yes. I would totally have her on my show as a theoretical proposition because I agree with you. Practically, I probably wouldn't because part of my – I just haven't engaged in a lot of these issues one way or another, partially because I find them to be at times just really trivial and not that interesting, the whole sort of college campus thing. You know, kind of roughly speaking. And I think, ironically, I actually think that what's hysterical is that there is, and I love that phrase, you know, the sort of culture, the anti-SJW industry or cottage industry or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly easy content, and it gives a lot of, you know, it juices audiences, whether it's a Dave Rubin audience or a Sam Harris audience or part of a Rogan audience or whatever. But I actually think, ironically, from a mass cultural and broad, like the people who should be most concerned about the kind of like dumb neoliberal woke or, you know, performative purity politics or dumbed down intersectionality, whatever way we're defining it, should actually be us on the left because we're, you know, potentially losing people to sort of. People who are just obsessed with essentially social manners and have no actual political analysis. And I think that is a problem for us. I'm still not really convinced that outside of some realms of social media and college campuses that, you know, people being uptight and ridiculous about like watching a Jordan Peterson clip as an example. I haven't been entirely convinced that that really is such a massively important issue other than one that, you know, is leveraged by these content creators. But number three, I mean, I guess I've started to my position has started to migrate a little bit because I think that, you know, it's sort of like it or not, this thing has made a real indent. And figures like Jordan Peterson are getting a lot of attention. And then troubling to me, even when they're getting attention, I mean, I watched that interview he had on the BBC, and it was terrifying. Because the truth of the matter is, from my perspective, there's plenty of things to pick apart in Jordan Peterson's presentation. But, you know, she didn't do it. I mean, she essentially was like sitting there as if she was Twitter. And she was berating him with tweets. And he ended up looking, you know, cool, calm, collected, reasonable. If you knew some of the things he was pointing to and saying, I think anybody would have a problem with it. And in the end, he got a little bit more into his demarxist, you know, he got into that. And that he started to get off the rails himself a bit. But there was about 20 minutes of that interview where she's basically saying, like, you know, you don't think women should make money. And he kind of would say, well, academic research suggests blah, blah, blah. And I actually coach women executives on how to get pay raises. He looked, in the context of that interview, like maybe a bit of a, you know, conservative fuddy-duddy, but a reasonable, polished academic. And she was just putting words in his mouth the whole time. And if that represents what people think our view is and where we're coming from, that's a, I apologize for being the socialist. I'm the socialist who always talks like this. That's a brand challenge for us. It's a bad look.
It's a really bad look. And it was actually on Channel 4 and not the BBC, not.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah, no, it doesn't matter. The thing about it is that there's two bad looks, though. The one bad look is the one you're talking about, where you come off like a like you're just a Twitter feed yourself, and you're just misrepresenting in real time and acting this way on national television and letting a right winger just have his way with you, basically. The other, though, is when you're like me, maybe when you focus too much on those kinds of incidents, because even that isn't that important. The only reason that it matters to me, Jordan Peterson specifically matters to me, is because he's doing a very good job of running down marks and in the public consciousness. After about a decade of increased interest in marks after the financial crisis, and to watch marks be pushed back into the 20th century as basically identical with Stalin, and to watch the worst excesses of liberal bourgeois capitalism be, you know, equated with Marx. Now, it's sort of quirky because I, you know, I'm one of these guys who started to read Marx after the financial crisis and started to care about that a lot. But that's, to me, why he's significant and why it's important to make these distinctions. But the other thing that happens is you try to make these distinctions, and if you're not an intersectional leftist, you get branded as basically not caring about racial issues at all. You know, you're not caring about gender issues at all.
Right.
And that's really difficult to overcome, although, you know, making an effort to.
You know, optics matter if you're trying to build any type of mass mobilization. And I think that, I mean, you know, in some ways, we're so emergent and grassroots that it sounds presumptuous to say, but I just believe that all of us that are involved in any type of politics that I think is really about a serious material intervention in people's lives, democratizing the economy, creating universal health care, I mean, anything on that continuum from, you know, genuinely sort of progressive, however we're using that word in the maybe we'll say in the New Deal or Great Society sense, to genuinely social democratic, to really thoroughly Marxist. Our goal has to be some form of mass mobilization, because that's actually how we win. And I think that it is important to realize, like, the ultimate endpoint from our politics cannot be a sense of being trendy or being cool or being in the know or something. I mean, all that stuff is fine and, you know, can be applied to certain worlds if you want it to. You know, you can be like a sneakerhead or on top of different music scenes or whatever. That's great, cool. But I think ultimately our politics has to be something that a broad set of people can grok and they can get. And there's a lot of different parts of that supply chain. I mean, I think that there's some super specialized conversations that need to happen amongst people that are really, you know, that have some influence and are kind of setting parameters, and those debates really matter. Then I think there's kind of I play a lot of, I think, the sort of middle ground where I'm working to kind of translate ideas out, but also having some of those, you know, trying to bridge some of those higher level conversations. And then down the road, you know, we're going to really need to have, you know, these concepts and these ideas and these movements need to be household things in order for us to succeed, right? Like, that's why I'm an unending defender of Bernie, because among many other things, the guy just got out there and put some very basic commonsensical justice ideas back out into the center. So I think optics do matter. Then I think it's, you know, incumbent upon us, specifically when you're talking about dealing with the kind of the alt-right or intersectionality as it's presented in the discourse now. I mean, what I do at times is I do a lot of a fair amount of global coverage in my show. So I'm interested sometimes in stories and movements that can illustrate lessons for what's happening in our contemporary politics that seem to be less shocking to people when they're injected from outside. So for me, like the African National Congress at its height, not to say that there aren't many problems with it in governance and crony capitalism and neoliberalism and all the rest, but the model of African National Congress in many respects as a revolutionary movement that was both obviously anti-colonialist, thoroughly anti-racist, did have a sophisticated race discourse, but also was in many ways very grounded in labor and socialism, and specifically preached non-racialism. And non-racialism from, you know, not in this ridiculous trash way that we get from the anti-SJW cottage industry, which is, you know, racism doesn't exist. And, you know, that's just old right-wing stuff in new packaging. But what you had among the really sophisticated revolutionaries of, and specifically now I'm talking the ANC, they actually in fact talked about non-racialism, and non-racialism being a sort of endpoint of a real, genuinely liberated social democracy. So when you start injecting those ideas and you start realizing that actually like very serious revolutionary left movements had very smart critiques of what we would call quote unquote identity politics today from a very operational lens, I think people are receptive to hearing those ideas. The only other thing that I'd say is I think it's very important. I think there's a real emotional intelligence question in all of these issues, because I think with a lot of people that are like, you know, quote unquote normal people, in the sense that they're not, maybe they don't have a position in academia, maybe they're not on social media all the time. If you are able to acknowledge and not be in any denial about all those various forms of oppression, which are real, that intersectionalists focus on, and so that we're not denying them or minimizing them, we just might have a different analysis of what causes them and how to address them, but we're not negating their reality. In my experience, that's a very effective way. And because it's also true, I don't gate the reality of any of that stuff at all. I just have a different assessment of it and how to actually truly defeat it, because I think ultimately, of course, that's part of our brief as leftists. We want to destroy every category of oppression imaginable. That's a big brief, but
right.
That's what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think of it slightly differently. Our aim is to develop new, more subtle forms of oppression. In other words, the struggle for survival should be off the table. The struggle right. for basic respect should be off the table. But we're never going to get rid of the way human beings like to torture each other. Because I just don't want to be called utopian by, I guess, by the Jordan Petersons of the world. So I was like, no, it's like, I understand. You've got some grip on human nature being kind of bizarre. I don't even disagree with you. It's just we can be bizarre and weird and not always nice to each other on a whole different level. Like, you know, the way people in a university department are awful to each other rather than the way that, you know, people are awful to homeless people or the dropping bombs. We can do a much more subtle form of torture.
Oh, Jesus Christ. That sounds like a fucking nightmare. I don't want to live in a giant college campus. I might prefer Jungian social Darwinism to that.
Okay, well, maybe you're right. but you know, no one would start, right? I mean,
one of the big reproaches to psychoanalysis is that it's only a theory of individual pathological disturbances, and that applying psychoanalysis to other cultural or social phenomena is theoretically illegitimate. It asks in what way you as an individual have to relate to social field, not just in the sense of other people, but in the sense of the anonymous social as such, to exist as a person. You are, under quotation marks, normal individual person, only being able to relate to some anonymous social field. What is to be interpreted and what not is that everything is to be interpreted. That is to say, when Freud says Unbehagen in der Kultur, civilization and its discontent, more literally the uneasiness in culture. He means that it's not just that most of us as normal, we socialize ourselves normally, some idiots didn't make it, they fall out, or they have to be normalized. Not culture as such, in order to establish itself as normal, what appears as normal, involves a whole series of pathological cuts, distortions, and so on and so on. There is, again, a kind of unbehagen, uneasiness. We are out of joint, not at home, in culture as such, which means, again, that there is no normal culture. Culture as such has to be interpreted.
The idea is that the development of civilization requires curtailing aggression and sexuality in individuals to make communal bonding possible.
I like seeing this as a contrast to utilitarianism. We are set up so that being happy all the time is just not even something that's a possibility for us, that the goal is psychologically implausible.
You know, I actually have two contradictory responses to that. So one, I think it actually is important, specifically when we're dealing with people like Peterson. And I do some stuff with these guys. They have this podcast called Mixed Mental Arts. Mm-hmm. And kind of in the sort of Rogan lane, Brian Callen and Hunter Motz, but really smart, not leftist, but kind of science and culture podcast, and they're trying to dismiss, they are trying to do some really valuable cultural debunkings, and they have people like me and, but also Peterson on. They have a big range of guests. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's value, though, not in having a Pollyannish view of human nature, but I think even among the quote-unquote hard sciences themselves, there's enough dispute about human nature that it's worth putting that into play. Like, so that every study that you can cite that sort of suggests that we're hardwired to be dicks, there's another study that's like, oh, you know, humans are natural cooperators, as an example. And I think it's worth it to complicate that discourse a little bit.
Right.
You know, there is neuroplasticity. There is a lot of different, and I think in some ways it's, you know, actually on that same podcast, I kind of, Brian, who's, you know, a comedian, actor, you know, real, kind of a libertarian-y guy, he kind of threw that at me, like the human desire to be competitive and to distinguish yourself as an individual. And I kind of just said, well, look, you know, kind of similar to what you're saying. Like I said, yeah, not everybody gets an NBA championship, but everybody gets healthcare, right?
Right.
We can easily make these distinctions. Yeah. And slot things into their proper categories. It's not that complicated. But I do think Peterson specifically goes so deep on the claims about how hardwired human nature is that that narrative does need to be disrupted a little bit in order to get out of his worldview. But the second thing that I would say that I've been thinking about a lot recently is I do think that there needs to be a lot more room on the left for just like, for less perfectionism about certain things. More like, you know, hey, if you're acting in a way that's like, you know, socially acceptable and you're not discriminating against people in your work and, you know, you don't vote based off of xenophobia as an example, maybe, you know, it would be better in the privacy of your life and in your attitudes if you were, you know, I think being a non, you know, a non-bigoted person generally makes for a much more interesting, better life experience. But I don't know how much I think that we can have more like what is the practical effect of your action in the world and how you're showing up versus like taking it through the entire chain of every single belief you had. I mean, I made this argument recently on my show, and I don't know how effective it was, but there's all this controversy about Dave Chappelle's new special. You know, look, some of the jokes he made about transgender people, I agree. They're pretty mean. Some of them are actually extremely funny and insightful. And then there's a whole other part, and actually like, you know, insightful of a sort of very the opposite of bigoted, in fact. And then there's another part of it where it's like, at the end of the day, he's saying, you know, respect people's rights. Don't use my shit to beat up on people. And if you are, you're like, don't come see my show. Fuck you. And I thought, you know, frankly, for better or for worse, like, Dave Chappelle is going to be a whole lot more persuasive for some normie on that issue than somebody who's like, you know, just going to come and demand complete enlightenment and perfection. I mean, that's reality. So I think, and Bill Burr, I mean, Bill Burr gets a lot, some very insightful ideas on race, I think, but he partially does it because, you know, he's a comedian. He can also say fucked up shit. And he also understands where a lot of people are and can kind of deal with it on their own terms. I agree with you that we can't wait for people to be, you know, morally perfected, you know, woke practitioners in order to have a socialist strategy or a left strategy. I think that's totally true. We're going to need to just have like, hey, you need to be respectful of people. You need to support everybody's civil rights. You need to be able to work in coalition with people. That's non-negotiable morally and practically. But at the same time, like, you know what? Not everybody's going to be the most evolved. And that just is what it is.
Yeah, right. And the other thing is, sometimes we're wrong about things. Because, look, the left doesn't have a perfect track record, you know, by any means. So, like, we've still hung over from the 20th century. We're still trying to figure out how to get our act together and make the world less of a nightmare. And the clock is ticking, right? I mean, we've got the atomic scientists moved the clock to 2 minutes to midnight in terms of Armageddon. I don't know how seriously to take that, but it seems to me that we're in a very tough spot where we don't actually have consensus on answers or I don't think there is a correct line right now. I think we're,
right.
You know, we're in desperate need to rethink. And at the same time, we want to be in a position of being moral authorities. And I don't think that's our best position. I think our best position is, you know, to be calling on everyone's self-interest and better nature simultaneously to try to make radical changes in the world so that we pull through and can maybe live, you know, in my vision of a Star Trek utopia or something, you know, like, you know,
yeah.
You know, we can do a lot better. We can not be perfect moral beings. And we're not on a Christian mission to save souls here. We're on a mission to make life better. So.
As far as Mr. Khrushchev's comments just now, they are in the tradition we learned to expect from him of speaking extemporaneously and frankly whenever he has an opportunity. I can only say that if this competition, which you have just described so effectively, in which you plan to outstrip us, and particularly in the production of consumer goods, if this competition is to do the best for both of our peoples and for people everywhere, there must be a free exchange of ideas. There are some instances where you may be ahead of us. For example, in the development of the thrust of your rockets for the investigation of outer space. There may be some instances, for example, color television, where we're ahead of you. But in order
I, you know, I didn't get to like the kind of questions that I would normally come at the beginning, like, you know, who the hell are you and how did you end up on the Majority Report?
I'm a morally perfected being and I'm on a mission to save souls.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, boom.
Okay. All right.
No, it was funny. I was actually talking with David Grisham, who's a, you know, brilliant dude who does some research for me on my show. And I'm just saying, like, you know, the left is too Christian. And I'm actually not. I'm not anti-religious, and I don't think being a kind of, you know, pedantic college sophomore about people's religion is also super counterproductive and annoying too. But I do think, in the sense specifically that you're talking about, that very kind of missionary sort of zeal and quest for purity, and, you know, who's in and who's out, and, you know, who and it is or isn't saved. And I think it's there, and it's a big narrative and emotional problem. And it's also a quest for certainty, like you're saying, in very uncertain times. So let me see. I'll try to condense it for you as quickly as possible. I was raised in the counterculture. My parents are kind of, you know, later hippies. And when I say that, I mean, like, genuinely, like, they kind of, you know, they left New York, kind of went up to Western Massachusetts, where I primarily grew up. We were really poor. There was no, you know, there was a lot of getting evicted from places and bouncing from house to house, and, you know, a sort of sense of, some sense of really not being enrolled in kind of quote unquote, you know, the system. Although my mom was very political and very working class. My dad kind of was, you know, pretty middle class and got kind of alienated in his experience of that. They both grew up in Long Island, which, I mean, God, hanging out in Long Island has given me compassion for my parents, because, I mean, fuck, man. So I sort of grew up in that way. I was very political, but also, you know, I also played sports. I also did a lot of drugs. I also was hungry to not be what I considered to be marginal, and, you know, kind of worked my way into a quote unquote, you know, I went to Bates, which is like a real, you know, New England private college kind of thing, and was very super embarrassed about my background, super embarrassed about us having no money and everything. And so I try to pass myself off as kind of a, you know, good, like, suburban Bostonite kid, like most of my peers at that school, even though in a lot of ways it was really boring. And I studied international relations. I studied in the Middle East. I had some other adventures. I left college for a little while, co-founded and ran a nonprofit up in Massachusetts. We reproduced New Works festivals, and I was doing stand-up comedy and sketch writing at the time. And so, yeah, that's part of the lens. And then after school, I bounced around for a couple of years. I did some work in kind of like the strategy space, a little bit of brand stuff. I was going to go to graduate school in London. And I met Sam Cedar, who's, you know, the main host of Majority Report. We had drinks. He offered me a job producing his show, basically over drinks. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I'll do that for a year. I've always wanted to kind of be in media, but didn't know how to pursue it. And, you know, I didn't have the kind of lane to it. I couldn't really, you know, I couldn't get subsidized to go to New York or something, or DC, and do an unpaid internship. That wasn't really in the cards. So I hosted the show, and moving ahead, I subbed for Sam when he was in he had a baby. So I shifted from a producing role to a little bit more of a hosting role, and then my role on the show just started, you know, changing. And, you know, and I do impressions, and there's a comedy bit, and I started hosting a show about once a week, and, you know, kind of like going on some of the global news outlets and writing some articles and starting to just sort of think like, oh, you know, maybe I could actually do this. And then launched my own show in August, and you know, fortunately, it's started really, really strongly. And I still do Majority Report with Sam's. Now I do Michael Brooks' show. Basically, there's like 3 shows a week for patrons, 1 show a week for non-patrons, and then Majority Report's a 5-day-a-week show. So it's a lot of talking on microphones in front of cameras, basically.
So did Majority Report start at Air America, or was that what he did after Air America?
No, it did start at Air America. So this started, you know, back, I think the show started in 2004. I mean, I came on like, I think in 2012. So I was already several iterations after that. I'm not sure how old you are, but we were, you know, I was just starting college around that time.
I'm an old guy. I'm 47. I can't believe it, but
I can't believe it either. Well, you young vibe, man.
Yeah.
So
that's what you keep when you accomplish little in life. You get that young vibe your whole life. That's really interesting. So he brought you in after he'd left Air America and he needed to have a producer for his new show, or was it like he was replacing someone or?
Well, yeah. I mean, he had another guy. It was me and a guy and one other person. And he had relaunched, I think, in 2010. And, you know, now it's kind of like, you know, pretty everybody's trying to do this model now. But it was one of the original, like, you know, it was a podcast and YouTube show. And, you know, it wasn't through, it was pre-Patreon, but it's the same model. You know, members, you know, pay a certain amount a month and they get the full content. And we did it out of this disgusting, wretched little studio in the Fashion District in New York City. Like walking on the street there, you felt like you could like step onto an STD. And then you just like go into this dingy little broom closet and we did the show. And then a couple of years ago, we moved to Brooklyn, and the show's definitely been growing. And Majority Report's interesting because it sits in the middle of a lot of different, like, you know, Sam had that thing a couple of months ago where Mike Cernovich tried to get him fired from MSNBC by taking that tweet out of context that Sam had satirizing Hollywood's attitude towards Roman Polanski. And the thing that was so funny was that everybody, I mean, partially it was because it was so egregious, but there was like genuinely like, you know, everybody from the kind of like Chapo boys who, you know, were friendly with to, you know, like Joan Walsh, you know, was like enraged by it. And Majority kind of has it plays that line of that doesn't really exist as much anymore, and that it's very much, I would say, you know, it's kind of like a broad left show. I mean, it's certainly like, you know, more Bernie, and, you know, Sam spent a lot of time at Occupy and was definitely ahead of the curve and very critical of Obama on everything from Wall Street to drones. But it's a show that you know, has a lot of buy-in kind of across the board.
I think of it as aligned with, not me, tell me if I'm totally off the charts here. Like, it's sort of the Democracy Now! Style show, or like Z Magazine style show, where it catches people who are considered themselves anarchists or Marxists. It catches Bernie bros. It catches anyone who's like a progressive leftist. And it probably has more of a perspective from, you know, on the Bernie side of things rather than the anarchist side of things. But you'll have Noam Chomsky on, and you'll have, you know, these thinkers who are radicals on, or and take them seriously. Is that would that
yeah,
be
about? I think that's a pretty fair description. Or even a guy like Derek Jensen's been on the show, you know, like a sort of like radical ecologist. I think it's funny. It's actually like, you know, it's definitely much more of a comedy and entertainment show than Democracy Now! And then conversely, it's a deeper dive than Democracy Now! You know, Democracy Now! Really is a great, like, Democracy Now! Is a great global news roundup from a certain left perspective. And I think Majority Report is still, you know, particularly if you're not a member, it's really a long form interview show. So that's a
The format's totally different.
I think you're right in terms of the kind of basic political, and it comes from that time when, you know, now I think both because of there's political changes which are really positive in that, and it's also just that the media landscape is so bifurcated. But I think that it also comes from a time when it was like, you know, instead of like, you know, we all don't like Trump, but we all have a million different sort of problems with each other and different ways of going about things. I think it goes back to a time when it was like, you know, everybody from like Noam Chomsky to the most, you know, mediocre Democratic congressman was like, okay, we got to get rid of Bush. You know, right. It was much more kind of uniform, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And there was a false sense of solidarity during Bush years.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And then it broke apart, you know, and then obviously the first fissures with Obama.
So I want to talk to you. I mean, this is maybe cheap in a way, because I want to talk to you about these celebrity types that don't like Jordan Peterson or Dave Rubin or the whole anti-social justice warrior industry. I want to talk about that because I want to get a hold of how important the alt-right really is and how much of it is a byproduct of this, that was happening to media in general, and how we're competing for eyeballs, and extremism bubbles up as a way to get market share. I mean, someone like Mike Cernovich, is he political or is he a self-help entertainer who's found an angle?
Right.
So what do you think?
I mean, so the question is, okay, so how important is the alt-right?
I mean, yeah, is that kind of... And how important is the anti-social justice warrior industry, which I think is really bigger than the alt-right and the alt-right?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that, well, you know, the way I see it is I kind of break it down into sort of three different categories. And in some ways, I think it's very important. And in other ways, I think it's kind of a flash in the pan. I mean, well, one part of it is that, you know, a couple of weeks ago on my show for the cold open on Michael Brooks' show, I played part of Pat Buchanan's 1992 speech, the Republican National Convention. And then sort of, you know, there's a clear through line there between that and Bannonism and Breitbart. Although, I guess to his credit, I mean, Buchanan was certainly a much higher caliber intellect. But, you know, this nativist stuff is nothing new under the sun. So I think in some respects, some of this anti-just JW stuff is just, you know, in the early 90s, there was a college campuses as our PC freak out. Obviously, in the 80s, there was this mass cultural backlash against the perception of, you know, what the 60s supposedly was. And I also think, in general, globally, right-wing parties who definitionally have a really narrow agenda in terms of who's essentially benefiting from their policies, they have to leverage grievances and identity of modern dominant groups. I mean, that's just reality, right? So to me, in some ways, it's just like, you know, video games and I can't say what I want to say or whatever is just the modern version of, you know, whatever the hell it was 20 years ago. You know, it's just updated and filtered through different memes. So I think in some way, I mean, so that part of it is like, yes, it matters, but it doesn't matter that differently than maybe it did matter, you know, sort of generally. There's always backlash. The second part, I think, for our purposes, though, is I do think that, you know, and I know that you've done a lot. I think you published Angela Nagle's book, right? Yeah. So, I mean, I buy most of her art. I have a couple of, you know, I have a couple of sort of relatively subtle disagreements with her, but I'm pretty much 90% with her. And I think that obviously, especially in a pop culture sense, this incredible, Like, if we know that there is a whole industry of either reactionary and or cynical and or, just sort of broadly uninformed about politics people out there, and they're going to build a whole content infrastructure based on, you know, in some ways to me, just trivial things, right? Like, hey, there was this thing, you know, some student was an idiot at Oberlin. Let's build a 3-hour block on that. You know, like, right? Like, okay, sure, whatever. But if you know that that is the case and you present such a just unbelievably fat inviting target for them, which I think particularly, like, I was starting to feel it. I really started to notice this in 2014, where it just really seemed like, I guess if you were spending too much time on Twitter, it was just like, oh my God. I mean, there is a contingent of people who identify on the left who think that, you know, I don't know. They almost reminded me of, like, you know, Tipper Gore being concerned about rap records, except, you know, filtered through being woke. You know, everything was and so I think that, you know, that the problem there is actually people on our side, right? The problem there is people is creating that opening through all of that sort of stupidity. But I think the third point, though, just to briefly note, is I think it is important as we make this critique, and it makes it so hard for us because we have to make so many distinctions. As ridiculous as so much of that, whatever we're going to call it, social justice warrior culture has become and is, I think we still have to remind ourselves that even a really downgraded and perverted and dumbed down version of that type of politics is still absolutely more evolved than, you know, just primitive, bigoted bullshit. No, and I think that's important for us to remember.
Basically, what we need to remember are the people who are ultra woke online are closer to us than the people who are, you know, Pepe loving clowns online. I mean, obviously,
yeah.
But what I wonder. Okay, what I really wonder about is whether or not what's happening is that the industries, let's say it's the YouTube industry or it's science fiction publishing, which I'm involved in as a writer, or it's podcasting or television, if that's leading how we react on the left as much as it is leading the normies or the people on the right. And like what you find yourself doing is working in this bifurcated way. Like, right. On the one hand, there's Keith Olbermann. On the other hand, there's what's his face from Fox News? It's not Tucker Carlson, but the one who was a sexual harasser.
Bill O'Reilly.
Bill O'Reilly. Yeah. I can't believe, think I'm actually grateful that name slipped my mind, but, So, you know, you have this war going on and the split between these two ideas is definitive, but there's actually a lot more overlap in ideology between the two poles than anyone will admit. Like the thing about Jordan Peterson that bothers me so much is that he is a lot closer to the postmodernism that he critiques than he ever wants to admit. And the postmodernists, by comparison, you know, also are a lot closer to being a Jungian Nietzschean conservative than they ever want. But that's never looked at because we don't make distinctions the way I want to make them. We make distinctions based on what the market is doing to us. That's something that if you're like entering into the market, and in some ways I feel like when it comes to podcasting and YouTube and all that, I'm just entering it, even though I've been doing a podcast for 9 years. That you want to keep in mind, you know, I've been called, the Marxist version of Dave Rubin, which is probably the most cutting insult I've ever
received. Whoever said that to you, you should have killed. I'm just kidding.
I did eventually block them on Facebook.
Yeah, that person's an asshole. Actually, it's funny though because that actually points to the type of problem that we, I'll get to your bigger answer, but that to me, like, and the problem is that this to me filters through various ideologies. Like, I actually know people who, you know, are there's dumb versions of all of these ideological categories, but like the fact that you could have somebody, and I've listened to a couple of your shows, you know, I like your work, and I listened to the interview that you did with the, I forget her name already, the woman who got terrorized for playing the Jordan Peterson clip. No,
Lindsay Shepherd. Yeah.
Yeah, Lindsay Shepherd. So if you could listen to that and you're like, boilerplate, like your response is, oh, he's the left wing, you know, Dave Rubin. Like, it's not just that, that's the part that starts it, because I actually, you know, I don't mind like taking shots and framing people's ideas in ways that are unflattering to them, because to me, some of this stuff actually is combat to some extent. But it's like, that's just not true. I mean, that to me, that just confers like, oh, you're not able to listen to and process information. And that's right. Disturbing, because if you have enough resources and enough interest where you're accessing pretty sophisticated content and you still don't have the kind of basic processing power to make a distinction between some, like, you know, cynical airhead in L.A. who, you know, does like the same show every week to appeal to like resentful goon teenagers, and, you know, somebody who's trying to really tease some things apart. I mean, shit, that's pretty depressing.
Yeah, I'm not saying there's no such thing as racism. I'm just saying it's not.
No,
the,
we understand.
Yeah, I'm just saying I agree that like, you know, yeah, there definitely is a desire to control. Like, if you're going in and dominating in, as an empire, a nation, you'll use every trick in the book to do so. What drives that is not primarily cultural identity anymore.
Doug, I mean, you know, if you take Marx as Hegel's son, mm-hmm. and if you've read, you know, Philosophy of Rights, Phenomenology of Spirit, and all this other stuff, and he's taking this from Kant, and I don't know if he was aware of Hume, I don't think he cared, but they're all writing about this particular need.
Yeah, I know, right? Hegel is. Hegel has the master and slave dialectic, and I know exactly what you're talking about, where you're trying to impose your will.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, but don't you think it's strange that the knowledge that there's so many people writing about this kind of desire, and then it immediately starts taking effect?
Well,
it's not capitalism that brings these thoughts over. It's the growing up simultaneously.
Look,
the content of race. Go ahead.
You know, Hegel was not the end of the line. I mean, Hegel didn't have an economic understanding. He thought that he was a statist ultimately, and he thought that the state was the ultimate authority, that things could be settled on the level of knowledge and will. But in fact, you know, what has to occur is for there to be systems of organization of actual productivity and work on an everyday level and in a productive level. And that's what changed dramatically. And that's why Marx talks about alienation and how the human being is alienated from himself, and our relations aren't taking place between humans anymore, but between commodities. So, but the point here is just I take this to be important, not because for a couple of reasons. One is, if we are no longer struggling against each other man to man, one race against another, but are struggling against a system that we've collectively now created to try to get a hold of it and change it, then we're in a much better position. I mean, the weird thing about capitalism is that it has broken down incompletely and in ways that are dangerous, but it has broken down barriers between different kinds of people, different kinds of ethnicities. You know.
Look, what you're saying. What you're saying is like, yes, women and gay and people of color should all try to shed this part of, okay, their subjectivity that they, let's say this is not a fact, but they think that it's holding them back, to shed that and come to where, let's say, white straight males are and join the revolution of class struggle.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm saying, because there's nothing white or straight or male about class. There's nothing white or straight or male about class. But there's nothing homosexual or Indian or black or anything else about class either. Class isn't class. It's not, class is not an identity. Class is not an identity.
What about the struggle for the class struggle? I mean,
there's nothing. I see no reason why that should be particularly ethnic or have any. It doesn't seem to me to have, you know, like I would never say that the struggle of the white miner in Pennsylvania is more working class than the struggle of the immigrant factory worker in some hidden slave labor factory in New York. They're both working class, and they're both struggling as class against the ruling class.
Yeah, but one of those people will not be living in fear of his life and his family a couple of days after the election of Trump. I mean,
well, no, yeah, you're absolutely right. Yes, right now, there's absolutely big political, cultural differences, but they're not class differences. Don't call it class, because that's not what that is.
What do you mean? You need a particular status to be in a
But it doesn't have anything to do with
class.
You can be still starving, and whether or not you feel, you know, like you can be in Flint, Michigan, and have voted for Trump, and you're still drinking lead. So there's that. The other thing is, those identities about you know, being a white worker, the whiteness is not your class. That's some holdover from something that doesn't, especially if you're drinking lead, doesn't matter.
To be in a certain level of class that directly demands of you a particular gender and a particular race, at least. I understand you're saying that when you both get to be in the working class, whatever that is anymore, your struggle becomes neutral or becomes shared.
Well, being in the working class,
the class has different
in order
levels.
To survive in the world, you have to work for a wage, and that what you produce isn't your own, but is sold by the capitalist for a profit. That's what it means to be working class.
No.
Yeah, that's what it means to be working class. That doesn't mean that you're white or you're black. Well, that's what it means now. That means that you go to work for a wage and you help produce something that you don't get to keep. That what you get is a wage. That's working class.
What about the reserved army? Are they part of a class?
Or you don't get to the working class? You're unemployed, but you're struggling to try to get into that position.
So there is no in the middle. There are no degrees of working class.
No, there are. There are degrees of working class as far as income and comfort, but there's no degree. But class is not an identity. It's a relationship to mode of production.
That depends on your identity.
No,
right?
It doesn't.
Where you are in the class?
No, it has nothing to do with your identity. It doesn't matter what you do. You can be paid less than the person next to you for whatever reason. You're both still working class. It has only to do with your relationship to the means of production. I'm not saying anything controversial here. I'm not trying to minimize anything either. I'm just saying you can align along class lines and not have to be the same race. That the class is not attached to any race. Your class.
I can't.
Well, yeah, I see it. It's more.
James, go.
I guess by processing power, I don't necessarily mean like intellectual capacity. I mean actually maybe enough emotional maturity to be able to hear something without getting so revved up by just a couple of flashpoints or buzzwords that you can't literally process what you're hearing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And so then the problem becomes like, okay, so why is that happening? Well,
right,
that's happening because we're living through a reactionary moment. I mean, we're living through a moment where Trump is in I mean, like, you know, it's scary. And, yeah, you get, people are on the, they're defensive. And I understand. So I don't condemn him as a person, but it really is very frustrating to be characterized that way. And it makes me pause too, because I really don't want to be contributing to the anti-social justice warrior industry.
Well, I just don't. I think, first of all, to your earlier point, I think there is an obvious, there's such a clear difference from a content perspective of people who have people who seriously take markets into consideration and people who don't. I mean, even if you're not coming from like a specifically Marxist, a specific analytic viewpoint, but there are people who. There are people who assess the world in a way that understands that there are vast and serious economic forces that drive a lot, and there's people that don't. And the common denominator, it seems, to people who don't, to me, is that everything is just a morality play and a morality conflict. And I think that that is a very baseline distinction. The other, you know, the other thing... The one thing that I would sympathize with I guess some of those people in that SJW lane, is I understand the desire. There's certain things that would be great if we had closed the chapter on, right? Like, look, it's fucking obscene and insane that we have a neo-Confederate attorney general. Yeah. We have a president who's a racist, even in the most like sort of just conventional use of the term. Right. Yeah. We or like for me, you know, I've been doing a series on my show of sort of doing some kind of idea debunking of certain people. And the fact that like I have to do an illicit history segment with Nathan Robinson from Current Affairs and really pick apart Charles Murray. I would like to think that, you know, he wrote this book in the 90s. A lot of people attacked it. From some, you know, from scientific, sociological, historical perspectives. He also clearly is what he is. Maybe we've evolved as a society. So part of, I guess, the impulse from that SJW thing that I have sympathy with is it's like, wouldn't it be nice if we had turned the page on some things? On the other hand, I mean, it disturbs me the extent, because I also read a lot of this stuff paradoxically as a lot of lack of confidence. Like, you don't feel, I mean, I debated Sargon of Akkad a couple of years ago, and I regret it on some level because, and you know, I was harassed by a bunch of like enraged, you know, pimply teenagers for a couple of days and, you know, and whatever. But like, you know, the idea that you wouldn't feel comfortable putting up your ideas against these total fucking mediocrities, and testing them out, that's disturbing to me that people don't see it that way. And also, you know, again, I think that, yes, there was of that, if we're talking about a persuadable middle of young people who were maybe drawn into some of that garbage, I think it's a different world now that there's stuff, that stuff like our stuff is a little bit more on the map. I think makes a difference. I think if you're the example I've been using all the time is if, you know, if you're kind of alienated 17-year-old, say, and, you know, I don't know, you can't have sex and whatever, and you're not that popular and you're obsessed with video games, you kind of fit that stereotype. And one group of people tells you like, oh my God, you know, you can't get your dick sucked because of feminism and blah, 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 blah. And really, you know, and playing video games is super noble. And what do you mean, like gender power structure? Like girls have all the power because they have, you know, they want to have sex with you. Like what, you know, all of this stuff, right? And then on the other hand, if you if you, you know, flipped over to what was presented as left, and it was like, you know, here are 20 times that Lena Dunham totally slayed the whatever. I mean, it's obvious what brands you're going to get turned on to. And I mean, I just think there was so many obvious places for people, for us to be persuadable, even in ways that had nothing, like not in any way kowtowing or feeding into misogyny or anything else, but just by, you know, being normal, being pop literate, being approachable, and also being like, you know, hey, like there's other things besides all this, you know, garbage you're reading online, like your student loans, or maybe why your dad makes less money, or why your mom has to work three jobs, or, you know, get this real in your life. And I think that that has power to it.
Or even, hey, you know, that video game you're playing, it is kind of cool. And if you think about it this way, it relates to this concept that's on the left, you know?
Right. Yes, I agree. I agree completely. Yeah, not demonizing. You shouldn't. I mean, my cultural lane is more like hip hop and sneakers and all that, whatever. But it doesn't. I mean, there's that great pod struggle session and champagne sharks. And like, you cannot, don't demonize people's, you know, unless you're just messing around. I mean, I make jokes about gamers all the time, but that's just because of, you know, it's just me being a dick. Right. Literally. I mean, I think there's a big problem, too, of like, that does come up in some of this discourse of like, you should not, we should not be in the business of innately demonizing anybody because who they are. And it doesn't mean that the consequences are all the same. And it doesn't mean, like, obviously if you do that to a young black person, that matters in a very different way if you do it than to a young white person. But as a general kind of broad concept, I think all that discourse of like toxic masculinity and white male tears and all this shit, it's like, you know, even for those of us who get it on some level and also just like don't care because it's not going to affect my day, I think you got to think for a second about how that is going to play out for normal people at some point. And normal people don't totally like to be completely demonized just for literally the fact of who they are. And that's not like an innately reactionary point of theirs either.
Right.
You know what I'm
saying? Right. Yeah, you're right. And I remember, I'm old enough to remember in the 70s where, you know, the left was saying things like, it's all right to cry, not I drink your tears, white man.
Get the sad out of you. It's all right to cry. It might make you feel better. Raindrops from your eyes. Watching all the mad out of you. Raindrops from your eyes.
The only other thing I'd add, and I don't know, only drop this in if it's easy, but I will say, and I do, obviously, I wanted to talk a touch about my show, but I really believe, and one of the things I do in my show for patrons is I have illicit histories on everything from Silicon Valley fascism to Jamaican gang warfare, the CIA and Caribbean politics. And it does seem to me that broadly speaking, I think that if we could, I think just a little bit more like real historical grounding across the board would be to our advantage. Just even like the ability to be like, oh, this whole campus thing, this sort of happened already in the 90s. And where can we learn from, you know, the dumb things that our side did, the reactionary backlash? I think that so many of these things are happening like in a literal vacuum where just even a bit of context around it would make things a lot more fruitful.